The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Doctors Without Borders, known internationally as Médecins Sans Frontières, or MSF, delivers emergency medical aid to people affected by conflict, natural disasters, and poverty all over the world. It is an NGO funded almost entirely by individual donations. Why, then, did MSF refuse to accept 1 million doses of a pneumonia vaccine from Pfizer? In a public post, the organization's U.S. director wrote, "Free is not always better," bringing the long, simmering impasse between MSF and a few pharmaceutical giants to a boil. Kate Elder is the vaccines policy advisor for MSF and had a hand in that discussion. Kate, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia.
So why did an organization focused on saving lives refuse 1 million pneumonia vaccines?
It's a good question, and it might not seem immediately obvious, but I think a little bit of important information is a bit of the context, the background, and just to know that MSF, Doctors Without Borders, has been trying to get access to this vaccine, the pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, the pneumonia vaccine, for a good 7 years now, because it's a critical tool for our operations, our doctors and medics in the field. Pneumonia is the leading cause of death for children worldwide. It kills almost 1 million children every year, and the vaccine, there are two vaccines that protect against pneumonia, one made by Pfizer and one made by GlaxoSmithKline, GSK, are really, they're very effective vaccines, so they're critical tools for the children we serve, as well as for children that MSF doesn't reach as well, children living in developing countries or children being served by other humanitarian organizations, partner organizations. So this is a long time discussion and debate and negotiation with the companies where we have been unsuccessful at accessing an affordable price. But recently, there have been some major milestones in this work with the companies. GlaxoSmithKline, Pfizer's competitor, recently decided to reduce their price after much of our public campaigning to the lowest global price. So that's a price that MSF can access, as well as other humanitarian organizations.
And what is that price at this point?
That price is about $3.05 a dose, just over $3. And kids require 3 doses to be fully protected.
Compared to on the open market, how much would it be?
Oh, it's a great question. Well, here in the United States, for Pfizer's product, our government pays about $136 a dose, and kids here in the States get 4 doses. So my math isn't that strong, but 136 times 4 is pretty hefty. So it's a significant price reduction. Of course, this is a price that GSK and Pfizer has offered a similar price of around $3 a dose to the world's poorest countries for a number of years. What we've been fighting to get access to is that lowest global price. And GSK has finally opened up access to that price for us and for other humanitarian organizations, but Pfizer has refused continuing to only offer donations.
So Jason Cohn, who is the executive director in the U.S. of MSF, or Doctors Without Borders here, points out that there is a cost to donated vaccines. What is the cost?
It's, you know, free is not always better, and this is the point we're trying to make, and there is nuance to this. Free is a business strategy, often of major pharmaceutical corporations. It's a way for them to take tax deductions. It's a way for them to boost their corporate social responsibility image, but there are many strings attached with free. For example, there's often limitations imposed by the donor. So not being a purchaser, a regular purchaser, you can't just buy the product and use it where you wish. There's often many qualifications to those donations. Like, for example, you can use them in this country, but you can't use them in that country. You can use them for this age group, but you can't use them for this age group. So that's sort of, you know, the first round of difficulties of accepting donations is the high strings attached, along with the long protracted negotiation period. I mean, this is not, these are not donations that all of a sudden overnight they're available. They are highly legal documents that require many months of negotiation back and forth with legal teams. While you work out, you know, what the donor is trying to impose and what's acceptable to the recipient. So those are just some of the immediate issues with donations. then there are much broader implications, more systematic implications of donations. For example, you know, if we accepted a donation, doesn't mean that the rest of the humanitarian community has access to the vaccine. And it's not only MSF, Doctors Without Borders, that's vaccinating children. It's many of our partner humanitarian organizations. So it might solve our problem immediately, but it's not solving the problem that many other organizations face, as well as governments themselves. So it's not that price has been an issue just for the humanitarian community. Price of the pneumonia vaccine is also an issue for developing country governments that want access to this critical vaccine to save their children. You know, here in the States, it's very easy for us to get our children vaccinated. We don't ask many questions. We don't even often know what the price is. We just assume it's going to be there. But for many developing countries, this pneumonia vaccine is not readily or generally available to children. And governments have been complaining for a long time that one of the major obstacles to making the vaccine available to their kids is price. And often the pharmaceutical companies even use donations as their excuse for why others need to, you know, so-called pay up. So we donated to MSF, so to speak, but that means you, government X, you need to pay your fair share. And it's often used as a justification for keeping high prices of governments.
So I can see, you know, you are making the case for not just yourself, other humanitarian organizations, developing countries. I mean, it's a very principled stand. It's a very long game to play. So how about, you know, the oath, doctors do no harm? How do you weigh that kind of refusal of vaccines with the potential loss of lives?
It's a great question because it's an internal discussion that we take very seriously, and it was a very considered and very, debated and angst-ridden decision for Doctors Without Borders to take. So we don't take this lightly, but being that we are in a new place with GlaxoSmithKline having recently offered their product, their pneumonia vaccine, for the lowest global price, so now we have one access route, we feel in a much better place to continue to protect children and to make sure that we're minimizing any consequence of rejecting this donation. We are willing to pay a price for this vaccine. I mean, we are waiting for the company to even just quote us a price. So not only have they refused to lower the price for us, they've just refused to even quote Doctors Without Borders a price at all. But when they do, you know, we will mobilize our resources and you know, in an effort to minimize any risk for our patients, we are willing to pay. But in the meantime, we have access to the competitor product, GlaxoSmithKline's product, and we are doing everything we can to minimize any consequences, you know, on our patients.
Well, Pfizer's response is that they strongly disagree with MSF's decision and that, quote, to suggest that donations are not valuable defies logic. Have the op-eds, have the refusal, all the times this is getting passed around, actually made a difference?
We think so, because GSK has finally responded to the pressure that the public has been putting on them to lower their price. And this is coming after, you know, more than a year of Doctors Without Borders and partners campaigning on this issue and pushing the companies to do the right thing. So we think the public pressure actually is having an impact. You know, of course, it's very difficult to anticipate how the public will see, you know, MSF's decision to reject a substantial donation offer from Pfizer. I mean, this is a topic that has a lot of nuance. It's not immediately obvious. So there was concern of how the public would understand this. But we are really pleased to see the press and media response to this. There has been a ton of coverage of the article that our executive director, Jason Cohen, put out on why we rejected this donation. 80-90% of the public seems to understand the nuance and understand the strategy that pharmaceutical corporations use in giving donation offers. So we're quite pleased with the public response. And Pfizer has now actually said, this is the first time that they've said that they are looking at other options besides just a donation offer. So I think that is an indication, we hope that's an indication, that they are taking this rather seriously and hearing the response not only of the public but the humanitarian community and organizations such as the World Health Organization and UNICEF that have very clear policies against corporate in-kind medical donations. We think that it's moving them to consider other options, so we're waiting eagerly to hear what those other options may be.
Kate Elder, Vaccines Policy Advisor for Medicine Sans Frontières, and she spoke with us about the organization's decision to refuse 1 million vaccine doses from Pfizer. Kate, thank you for speaking with us.
Thanks so much, Virginia.
And you can find a link to read Jason Cohen's op-ed at wordofmouthradio.org. We just heard about an organization weighing multiple complex factors with its long-term mission to save lives. Well, for most of us, those considerations are much more banal, like deciding to eat a hamburger for lunch. That's part of an argument made by James McWilliams in an article for Pacific Standard. Here's the rub. Drug-resistant superbugs are on the rise because of over-promiscuous use of antibiotics. Superbugs kill more than 700,000 people each year. Public health officials want medical professionals to back off from overprescribing antibiotics for their patients. In reality, more than half of antibiotics used globally go to farm animals. And on U.S. farms, that number is closer to 80%. One of the reasons activists advise against eating factory-farmed meat. McWilliams writes that people who consume factory-farmed meat and dairy endanger the health of others, which is no different than the anti-vaxxers blamed for reintroducing measles, mumps, and other infectious diseases to the population. James McWilliams is a professor of history at Texas State University and frequently writes about food politics and safety. James, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me on.
So that is a bold statement. So fill it out for us, please, that comparison between those who eat factory-farmed meat and those who refuse to vaccinate their children.
Well, I think the comparison holds up on a pretty basic principle, which is that, you know, there are certain issues for which we all have to participate collectively, or it doesn't work. And this is certainly, I think, more obviously true for vaccinations. If there's not widespread vaccination, if, you know, critical mass of people are not vaccinated, then there are, you know, dangers of reintroducing these diseases back into the population. And, of course, the diseases can then change ever so slightly so that they get past the vaccination that other people have gotten. So the idea of everyone collectively participating is super important to something like vaccination. And I hadn't really made the connection to antibiotics and superbugs until I was just doing some background reading for an article that I was going to write on antibiotic resistance, you know, building on this recent UN dedication to that concern. But as I was reading, it kind of hit me as I read about factory farming and the application of antibiotics and how it pretty much was inevitable that the more that antibiotics were used in factory farms, the more superbugs were going to be created, that consumers are in many ways under a very similar kind of obligation to collectively avoid factory farmed meat, because by eating it in any way or supporting the industry in any way, we're supporting the application of these antibiotics and therefore supporting the promotion of these superbugs. The superbugs don't care whether you eat meat or not. So on a personal level, it's not as if you can say, well, you know what, I'm a vegetarian or I'm a vegan, so I'm opting out of this problem. It's not my problem. That's not how superbugs work. Very much like the disease that we vaccinate ourselves against.
Well, you mentioned the UN taking this on. For the first time ever, there was a UN General Assembly in September about the topic of superbugs. But there is also, you know, you mentioned the collective, but there's some nuance here in this social contract. I mean, food producers argued that antibiotics means that they can farm in much larger quantity, you know, that maintaining and controlling animal agriculture on an industrial scale means you have to factory farm in order to feed so many people. So from this, the broadest view, the socioeconomic opposites of those least likely to have means or access to chemical-free organic meat, there's an inherent judgment in sort of blaming those who eat factory-farmed meat.
Yeah, I mean, it's a super complicated issue if we want to look at it in terms of the class politics and sociology. You know, I mean, I didn't get into that in my piece. I really just looked at the medical issue and the public health consequences. But to highlight and to sort of respond to the, I think, really interesting claims that you're bringing up here, there's absolutely no doubt that the factory farming practices methods that lead to cheap meat, and that, you know, this is going to always play a significant role in the vast majority of the population choosing factory-farmed meat. I mean, 95% of the meat that we buy in this country is factory-farmed. You know, we're not doing it because we love the way that it's produced. We're doing it because it's cheap, and it's cheap because the methods of factory farming make it so. There is no easy way to get around that. However, I think that campaigns to suggest that we eat far less meat. Americans are some of the highest meat eaters in the world. We eat about 270 pounds of meat a year, and it, you know, strikes me as perfectly reasonable to undertake public health campaigns suggesting that we eat far less meat. But the other way to look at this is to actually ask factory farms to pay for the full cost of production, and then it wouldn't be so cheap. So, like, the pollution that's caused by factory farms, I mean, they rarely have to pay for the pollution that they cause to aquatic ecosystems. Right now in North Carolina, hog farms, particularly with recent flooding, have done extensive damage because they have these manure lagoons that overflow and affect local water supplies. They don't have to pay for that, but if they did have to pay for that, I mean, I can assure you that the costs would go up significantly. And if you wanted to take this a step further and actually look at a lot of the public health consequences, including superbugs, that lead people to become sick, what if that was factored into the cost of production? Well, I mean, then I think you'd have a situation where, you know, small farms producing meat in a more responsible fashion might actually be more competitive.
Well, James, thank you for speaking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
James McWilliams, a professor of history at Texas State University. He frequently writes about food and food safety and politics. There's a link to read or comment on his piece for Pacific Standard, "Does Eating Factory-Farmed Meat Put One on Par with Anti-Vaxxers?" The link is at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. When local governments cut back, there is always a lot of talk about essential services, those duties that everyone expects to be performed. The jobs may not be glorious or even desired, but without them, towns and cities would be hard-pressed to function. Producer Richard Paul spent the day with Albert Rowe, nicknamed Motormouth, who carries out an essential service for Washington, D.C. He collects trash.
My name is Albert M. Rowe, Jr., and I'm an environmental technician. That's what they call it. But all it boils down is that I'm a trash man. Our day starts around about 6 o'clock, 6:30 in the morning, and it roughly runs to about 2:45.
Why do they do it so early in the morning?
Because traffic. Stop the traffic.
You guys don't seem to talk to each other much while you're doing this.
You can't be joking and jiving behind here. You get hurt behind here. You might see a rat or anything. They jump right up on you. Maggots, anything could be in this trash. Dead animals, anything. You'd be surprised what people put out.
What are some of the strangest things you found?
Dog, cat. I ain't never found no baby in there. I'm gonna tell you that. You got a lot of paint cans. All kind of ammonia, all that stuff's in this. Acid, anything to be in these cans. We don't know. Pick the grain at the bottom right there. Got it? Come on out.
I thought people were supposed to bag their trash.
Well, you know, people gonna do what they want to do, so you know how that goes.
Is it true that you can tell about people from what's in their trash?
Yeah. You can tell if it's slobs or whatever, you know. You got on this route, you got a whole lot of slobs. Reason why they're slobs is because they are, you know, the way they put the trash. They put the trash out like that, you can imagine what the house looked like.
Now, you're going to reach a lot of people when this thing is broadcast. What sort of advice would you give them to make your life easier?
I'll put it this way. Think about yourself doing this job, you know. Be a little more considerate, you know. That's all I can say. Set the trash out right. Put trash in bags. You're going to another alley. You don't want to get inside now.
Now I'm getting in the cab. What do you guys do?
We're going to ride on the back. Hold, Max.
And what's it like hanging off the truck at 30 miles an hour?
Nice breeze.
What sort of personality do you think makes a good trash man?
Well, you got to have a positive attitude. I make the most out of anything I do.
There's a nice sort of rhythm to this, isn't there?
Yeah. Once you get in that mode, you know, like rolling, sweating and stuff like that, you know, it's like anything.
Good exercise.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I would think that a lot of people would wonder what draws somebody to this line of work.
I enjoy it because of the simple reason it's outdoor work. I mean, let's face it, I haven't had a cold in about 12 years.
Really?
Yeah, because see, Bob, being outside, you're getting fresh air. Snow takes a lot of, you know, snow kills a lot of germs. People work inside, have more cold. people outdoors. Just keep right on kicking.
Does it ever bother you that there are a lot of people that have a negative image of this job?
Not really, because I'm going to tell you something. It's what you make of it.
So you really are doing the work that you want to be doing at this point?
Yeah, honestly, yeah. I'm doing exactly the work I want to. I like this. I like the work. The biggest fun and fun of this whole job. And I'll be honest with you, it's the last can. Right, give me a gear, Max.
And that story was produced by Richard Paul for the series People Who Work. Anyone who's watched a spy movie or crime show has seen them. Grainy security camera images blown up, enhanced, and run through a facial recognition database with amazing results. That's a database of criminals, right? A report from the Georgetown University found that half of American adults' facial features are already in law enforcement's facial recognition network. That's more than 117 million Americans whose faces can be located in databases accessed by at least a quarter of local and state police departments, unbidden and unregulated. The report's authors argued that it is a gross violation of privacy for millions of law-abiding citizens. Claire Garvey is an associate with Georgetown Law School's Center for Privacy and Technology, which published the report. She focuses on facial recognition. And Claire, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much.
So 117 million people, just around one in two adults in the U.S., are already in facial recognition databases. How does all that information end up there?
That's right. So about one in two American adults have now landed up in a face recognition database that police can actually either directly search or request searches of. And that happens simply by standing for a driver's license photo in any one of 26 states across the U.S. People have been enrolled in these face recognition networks that can be used for criminal justice purposes.
Now, I know that accuracy is often an issue in biometrics and facial recognition, but the FBI says that they do still have human beings confirming matches. Are these matches accurate?
So face recognition is a very new technology, and it makes mistakes. The FBI has estimated that it is about 86% effective. What does that mean? The systems usually return a list of possible results. So let's say it's a list of 50 people. And that means 86% of the time, or 6 out of 7 times, one of those 50 people will be the right suspect. But 1 out of 7 times, that will be a list of completely innocent individuals. And here's the other thing. Face recognition makes mistakes. It makes more mistakes on certain people, particularly African Americans, women, and young people. What this means at a very simple level is that if you're an African American, a woman, or somebody under 30, and you are in a face recognition database, you are more likely to be misidentified as a possible suspect. And that's a problem.
Is racial bias inherent in the technology?
I think what's important to realize is that the algorithm itself might be race blind. But depending on how the algorithm is trained, what photo sets it looked at to learn how to identify people from photos, and also the quality of images, it may perform worse on certain people.
I'm sure that people are hearing this thinking it's not a real surprise. I mean, it feels like this has been coming for some time and that various forms of citizen surveillance have been used, let's say in the UK, where defenders argue that this is good for fighting crime and for state security, leading to the question of why should an innocent person be concerned that their face is out there?
Sure. This is undoubtedly a very valuable tool for law enforcement, and we want it to be used to identify the perpetrators of serious crimes, and we're certainly not asking for a ban. We don't want it to be used to identify jaywalkers or peaceful protesters. We don't want it to be used to identify anyone at any time and for any reason. And what this risks is it risks changing the way people behave in public. We've already seen that face recognition was used on the protests following the death of Freddie Gray in police custody in Baltimore. The photos that people themselves posted to social media were used to identify and to locate certain protesters so that the police could arrest them. First Amendment rights, the right to participate in protest, in public speech, is so fundamental to being an American, to participating in government, and face recognition risks chilling that right.
Well, so what is the report arguing for?
The report is arguing for controls. Right now, there have been very, very few laws passed that touch on face recognition, and no laws that comprehensively regulate face recognition. So what we have is a system where we have to rely on the agencies themselves, the agencies that are using face recognition, to rein it in. And by and large, they haven't. We want this to be a public dialogue. We want the communities on whom the technology will be used to have a voice in deciding how it will be used. And we actually call, because the enrollment of driver's license photos is such an unprecedented step, we are actually calling for a moratorium on this particular use of the technology.
Well, you mentioned driver's licenses, but also in context of the Freddie Gray protests, pictures that people had posted on Facebook. So is that also a source of biometric data for law enforcement?
That will be the source of what they call probe photos. So the databases are largely set, and they're either driver's licenses or mugshot databases. The probe photos, the photos of people that they want to identify, can come from surveillance camera footage, they can come from cell phone video and photos, and they can come from what people post to social media.
There's another finding in your report that is quite disconcerting, that some major metropolitan police departments are using real-time facial recognition on the general public. Now, could you explain what that means?
That is the use of face recognition in conjunction with live feed video cameras. When we walk through a city like LA or Chicago, there are thousands and thousands of cameras. And what this means is that face recognition would turn those cameras into systems whereby the police could identify not just what's happening on the ground, but who is walking past that camera. And the risk here is that people could start to be tracked by the cameras throughout cities by the use of face recognition. There are laws on the books that prohibit the tracking of individuals without a warrant by other technological means. There are no laws that prohibit this same tracking to be done by face recognition.
Claire Garvey, an associate with the Georgetown Law Center on Privacy and Technology, which published a report called Perpetual Lineup, Unregulated Police Face Recognition in America. Claire, thank you for speaking with us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
You can find more on the report at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. In August of 2014, protesters took to the streets of Ferguson, Missouri, after Michael Brown was shot and killed by local police. Later that same year, protests over Brown's death were also happening in an unlikely place, a school in Maine. This piece was produced by Lila Cherniff last year.
These days, there are a lot of conversations about race. I mean, about the conversations we should be having about race. And this story, like so many of the others, begins with no one talking.
We walked through the schools and no one was talking about it. It was as if nothing happened the night before.
This is Muna Muhammad. She's a senior at Lewiston High. November 24th was the night that the Ferguson grand jury announced they would not be indicting Darren Wilson, the cop who killed Mike Brown. Muna goes to school the next morning, hoping
there was going to be some sort of, oh, I heard last night and I'm sorry, like, oh, that's crazy, I can't believe the world is like this. But no, people were just laughing about something they saw on social media instead.
Muna's senior class president at Lewiston, which you can almost tell by the way she conducts herself. And she's also been chosen to go to Washington, D.C. as a representative for the state of Maine in the U.S. Student Senate. Muna has brilliant eyes that seem to take in everything around her. And she tells me that the day after the news in Ferguson, she was shocked, both by the verdict and then by the lack of reaction at Lewiston High.
Well, my friends and I ended up together after school, and we were just appalled. We're like, we're done with this school. Nothing's ever going to change. We lost a lot of hope. No one's ever going to acknowledge racism.
Shocking things are happening around the country, and it feels like it's being ignored at Lewiston High. But then Muna goes online, and she sees that students all over the country are planning protests at their high schools, and they get the idea to do the same at Lewiston. So Muna and her friends go into school early the next morning to ask permission. The administrators say no. They say a walkout would be disruptive, teachers would be angry, and the students might get suspended as a result. They suggest making posters instead. Muna's friend Chandler decides to do that. Chandler's white. She's the only white student involved in planning the protests. She moved to Maine 2 years ago from Jackson, Mississippi, where she was one of two white students at her school.
And I came to Maine and there wasn't as much knowledge about like civil rights. Like in Mississippi, we didn't have a civil rights month. It was just black history and white history.
And Chandler was also surprised by how little anything was being talked about at school. So Chandler decides to make the posters at home one night. Whiteout marker on black paper. They say,
Black Lives Matter, and then a lot of quotes from people who had been victims of police brutality.
Chandler brings the posters into school the next day. She and another friend tape them to the white cinder block hallway wall. The rest of the hallway walls are cluttered with the announcements for sports games and club meetings that probably line every hallway of every high school everywhere. When Iman Abdellah, a junior at Lewiston, saw the posters, she felt hopeful. Iman has a ready smile and glowing cheeks, and when we talk, she sits on the very, very edge of her seat.
I was just waiting for someone to, like, for people to take action, people to, like, have awareness of it, to talk about it in classes and stuff like that. And no one ever did. So when these posters were made, I was really, really excited. I was like, yes, finally.
With a population of more than a quarter students of color, Lewiston High is one of the most diverse high schools in Maine. All the girls tell me this. They're proud of it. But they also tell me it has a long way to go. For example, the faculty and administration at Lewiston, nearly all white. And they say race-related issues aren't addressed much in school. Which is all to say that Friday, seeing Chandler's Black Lives Matter posters in their high school, it felt significant. But then on Monday, Chandler gets called to the principal's office.
I'm not sure how they found out that I was the one who had made them. There were four people involved, and they only called me to talk about it. I don't know why.
Why do you think they called you?
I mean, I was white, and maybe they're more comfortable discussing race with a white person. It was like two administrators in this meeting, and then me. I was scared, like the principal, and I guess he's the vice principal. It seemed like they were mad at me.
So Chandler doesn't remember exactly what was said, word for word, but the gist was that the posters needed to come down. Muna says that when she heard the administration had ordered Chandler to take the posters down, she was furious. She posts a video to Twitter of Chandler unpeeling the hand-drawn Black Lives Matter posters off the walls of the high school. And it gets attention. A lot of attention. A reporter from the Portland Press Herald picks it up. And the next day, the paper runs a headline reading, Lewiston students try to raise their voices, but protest interrupted. Along with a photo of Muna, Chandler, Iman, and another friend, Kalgil Issa, standing huddled together outside Lewiston High with the sprawling brick building at their backs. And then everything changes.
So after the article came out, eyes were all over us. We were the people to watch. It was kind of weird to be in that position. Then we got called down by the administration, our principal and assistant principal, and we're told it was a policy issue. But afterward, we got to hang the posters back up.
But that's not the end of it.
People in our own school were kind of like destroying or like putting other posters on top of the Black Lives Matter posters, and they were like putting White Lives Matter too, or Black Lives don't, that's not the only lives that matter, or All Lives Matter.
In January, Linda McKenzie, principal of Lewiston High, resigns from her position, although no public statement has been made about whether or not it was connected to this issue. Meanwhile, the superintendent approaches the girls and suggests they organize a community dialogue to talk about race, open to everyone. For weeks, the students work to put it together, each of them leading different workshops on race and privilege, and one specifically on the posters. There's a great turnout. And then, the next day, they're back at school.
I mean, the dialogue was amazing. I think the only thing that we should have done was directed more at the students here, like directed to people who don't actually agree with it, because right now there's people who agree upon it and the people who don't, but then we're not interacting at all.
The posters were moved, put under glass casing on the civil rights team bulletin board so they couldn't be defaced. But Chandler and Iman told me one day they found them in the trash. They're still not sure what happened. When I visited the school, it was February, and by that point, the posters were no longer up. They'd been replaced with a display commemorating Black History Month. Here's Iman.
I wish, you know, more of my teachers were more comfortable with talking about stuff. I don't know, just more conversation in the school, like, with students here, because, like, I have to go to school with all these students, and I'd rather not be that girl that was in the newspaper that annoys them a lot, like, or the girl who that civil rights girl that they don't like.
Before I left, I asked Iman if there was anything she wished the administration at Lewiston High understood that they don't.
I wish they understood that none of this was, like, an attack on them, and I wish that I could talk more with them, because I feel like I haven't talked to any of them. I don't know, talking to them, just, like, if I could do that, it would be pretty cool.
For Salt Radio, this is Lila Chernoff.
It's time for The Bookshelf, when NHPR's Peter Biello speaks with authors who live in or write about the Granite State. This week, young adult novelist Chelsea Philpott.
Once upon a time, there was a gentle giant of a boy, and he fell in love with an unknowable mystery of a girl who did not, could not love him back, at least not in the way he loved her. So begins the new young adult novel by New Hampshire author Chelsea Philpott. Part road trip, part love story, part exploration of one's purpose in life, the book takes us from Florida to New Hampshire and puts its young protagonist face to face with people from a world much different from the one he grew up in. The book is called Be Good, Be Real, Be Crazy, and Chelsea Philpott joins me now to talk about it. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Glad to be here.
So tell us a little bit about the duo at the center of the book, Homer and Mia.
Homer is a sheltered 18-year-old. Who's trying to figure out what he wants to do with his life. Mia is a free-spirited whirlwind of a personality, just kind, gregarious, outgoing, who wants to do right by Homer, and somehow this odd couple comes together.
Worth noting that Mia is pregnant, and that is, I think, is what you meant when you wrote that first line, this unknowable mystery who could not love him in the way that he loved her.
Well, actually, the concept, I think a lot in terms of concepts when it comes to writing, particularly with books, and I just fell in love with the idea of how love can be lopsided, unrequited love, or love where one person is loving a little bit more than the other person. So that's actually what I'm referring to in the first chapter, just the dynamic of Homer and Mia's relationship. Mm-hmm. That changes for the better.
For the better, sure. And it certainly develops as they make their way north in an old car that they refer to as the Banana, this ugly, stinky, yellow car. Mm-hmm. So you talk about unrequited love as inspiration for this. Tell us about the other aspect of the book, the road narrative. This is a time-honored tradition in American literature, of course. What drew you to this particular structure for a story about unrequited love or lopsided love?
I think it's an author's rite of passage. You must write a road trip story at some point, or you get kicked out of the American canon or something. But I love road trip stories. I always have. And I wanted to write a road trip story that was as much about the freedom of being on an open road as it was a pilgrimage. I've had so many strange and varied inspirations for this book. The parables are meant to echo Canterbury Tales, and Pilgrim's Progress, Wizard of Oz was an inspiration. And I mean road trip books broadly here. Of course, On the Road, a lot by Bill Bryson. There's something so tempting about a road trip narrative, particularly teenagers, because you have coming-of-age themes, and any trip, road trip, plane trip, boat trip, changes you in some way.
Road trips are something that at least when I was a teenager, it was always something I wanted to do because my freedom as a teenager, rightly so, was constricted. My parents didn't let me do everything I wanted to do. This is something that teenagers love to think about. When you're writing for a teenager, are you attempting to deliberately think about what are the things that teenagers want to do and then write a novel about that? Is that where that goes? Or is it just something naturally you're curious about?
It's something I'm naturally curious about. I like writing for teens because I feel like I'm never done myself, and by that I mean that I think we're always becoming the person we want to be, the people we want to be. And that theme, that exploration, is conducive to YA literature. It does draw on my own experiences. A road trip I took with my best friend that went the length of Oklahoma and involved the worst Thai food I hope to ever eat. And I took the train from Washington, D.C. to San Francisco and got stranded in the Mojave Desert for a few days. And the crazy stories that came out of those experiences were ones I had as an adult, but I felt could be encapsulated in a road trip narrative.
You wrote on your blog, I'm going to quote you here, "I used to think writer's block was a myth, and then I started working on my second book. Now I know that writer's block is real, and it's the worst." You were referring to this new book, right? This is your second book.
Yeah. This book nearly killed me. I'm exaggerating, but only,
well, tell
only
us
a
the story. I'm curious about how it went down.
Oh, God. I started to write Be Good, Be Real, Be Crazy in earnest after the publication of my first book, Even in Paradise, in fall 2014. And it was the worst because I had to write this book, and yet I just wasn't feeling the motivation. I don't know what it was. It was the schism that opens up after you accomplish a dream. I had published my first book, so what now? And the idea of a second book just seemed kind of a letdown. So that combined with second book syndrome, where you're stifled about writing the second book because you know too much and you also know what you don't know in terms of the publishing industry, reviewing, what it means to put your work out in the world. So, yeah, that and just the news. It seemed like maybe because I was in such a lull or a bit of a hole after Even in Paradise, I guess, but I noticed the news more and everything was terrible. There were earthquakes in Nepal and riots in Baltimore, and every headline stuck out in capital letters. So I think eventually I was able to turn that writer's block into questions that became the questions I wanted to explore in Be Good, Be Real, Be Crazy.
What advice could you give for someone who is facing their own version of writer's block?
Be kind to yourself. You can beat yourself up because you're not writing your 1,000 words a day, or you can just put yourself in front of your laptop and write whatever you can, even if it's terrible. Most first drafts are a multi draft. I think through writing. So in order to think through a story, even to know what my story is, I have to write it out. So for anybody struggling with writer's block, I would just be aware of the immediate, which is you're at your desk, you're going to write something, even if it's bad. And then the bigger picture, it will get done.
Well, Chelsea, thank you very much for coming in and speaking about your new book.
Thank you for having me.
That's Chelsea Philpott. She's the author of the new book, Be Good, Be Real, Be Crazy. And you can find a list of the top 5 books on Chelsea's bookshelf at nhpr.org.
And that was Peter Biello with The Bookshelf, which you can listen to here every other Wednesday or anytime by downloading the podcast from iTunes. Thank you for your listening time today. Music in this episode came to us from Blue Dot Sessions, Paddington Bear, and Persona La Ave. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org, including a subscription to the Word of Mouth podcast, so you won't miss a trick. I'm Virginia Prescott, back tomorrow at 2 with more Word of Mouth, right here on NHPR.